Air Temple Island was no stranger to dramatic entrances. Any time even one sky bison arrived, it was an occasion. In the summertime, when virtually the whole air nomad nation passed through as part of its unending cycle of migration, the spectacle was such that people would park boats out in the harbor and watch the comings and goings with binoculars and telescopes. It was one of the major events on the Republic City's social calendar. The show that took place an hour or so later was not on that scale, but the residents of the island, particularly the youngsters, took even greater delight in it than they did the coming of the summer migration. For one thing, there was a lot less work to be done, and for another, the arriving aircraft was of a type many of them had never seen before, which aroused a personal as well as professional interest. For his part, Corbin had, inasmuch as he'd even thought about it, assumed that Minami and Ryo Sato would be arriving by boat, either the ferry or their own. He knew from prior experience that Minami had a passion for powerboats. He still vividly remembered an afternoon spent aboard her steam launch, charging up the coast to whatever that little town was called with the green market. Instead, as the sound of her and her brother's arrival drew him outside to witness it, he was amused and delighted to find that they were coming by air, aboard one of his very favorite early aviation contraptions. "Huh," said Utena as they jogged together toward the plaza near the Bagua Circle, where the craft was setting down. "A helicopter? Hang on, no tail rotor." She brightened as comprehension arrived. "An autogyro? Wow! I've only seen those in Crimson Lizard movies." Grinning, she added, "I suppose that stands to reason. I mean, Minami basically is a Koji Aho character." Corwin laughed. "I'll tell her you said so," he remarked. They arrived at the circle to find the younger airbenders and acolytes crowding around, curious about this strange machine but unafraid. Ryo, in the rear cockpit, shouted and waved for them to keep clear of the propeller, but he needn't have worried. They might never have seen an autogyro before, but they knew what a prop was and why to avoid it. A moment later it spun down to a stop as Minami cut the engine. With the rotors gently windmilling to a halt a safe distance above, she climbed out of the front cockpit and jumped down to the ground. Once there, she took off her leather flying helmet, shaking out her long, wavy black hair in a gesture that was so obviously unstudied and yet so effortlessly glamorous that Utena was reminded, not for the first time, of Juri Arisugawa. Near the front of the little crowd of youngsters, Tenzin and Gyatso glanced at each other in astonishment, their cheeks going red. Beside them, Sita hauled off and slugged Tenzin in the shoulder, nearly knocking him down. "Hello, all," Minami declared cheerfully as she began tugging off her gloves. "Can I trouble a few of you to help me tie this beast down, please? We don't want it wandering off if the wind comes up." She had no shortage of volunteers for the task, which was accomplished in mere moments. Then, tossing her gloves into her helmet and the whole affair into the cockpit, she trotted across the paved area to give first Corwin, then Uchna, a hug. "Hey, strangers," said Ryo, who opted for the manly handshake instead. "You've got this whole town in an uproar." "Not really our intention, but it sort of started without us, and we ended up deciding to just go with it," Corwin replied sheepishly. "We'll have to get into that later. First things first, though," he said with a mischievous grin, as the four of them started back toward the house. "Come on and meet my newborn daughter." Ryo stopped walking. "I'm sorry, I could have sworn I just heard you say, 'Come on and meet my newborn daughter,'" he said conversationally. Corwin paused and turned back, still grinning, while Minami halted next to her brother and stared at him in turn, and Utena giggled at both of their reactions. "I did," he said cheerfully. Ryo pondered that for a moment, then raised a finger as if to object, then lowered it and thought some more before saying slowly, "Now, I realize I'm not the most observant prairie hog in town sometimes." He glanced pointedly at Utina and concluded, "But I was definitely clocking your good lady thoroughly enough the other night that I would have noticed a thing like that." Utina would probably at least have considered punching most guys, particularly most relative strangers, for a remark like that. But coming from Rio, it was so straightforward and sincerely complimentary that she found herself just rolling her eyes with a wry little smile and a slight blush, which deepened a bit when Minami put in helpfully, "For the record, I concur." "Well, I did say there were a couple of someones I wanted you to meet," Corwin said, gesturing for the Satos to get moving again as he resumed his course for the house. He said nothing more until they arrived. Utina knocked on the bedroom door jamb and put her head around to make sure new company was appropriate, then entered, waving the others in after her. The airbender elders had gone, but Korra remained, slouching in the chair Utina had placed earlier, her own feet up on the bed. "My, my, we are popular today, aren't we?" Anthy remarked to Annabelle with a smile. "Anthy, this is Minami Sato and her brother Ryo. I've told you about them," said Corwin. "Guys, I want you to meet my daughter, Annabelle Tenjo, and her mother, Anthy Tenjo." "I'm very pleased to meet you," said Minami with one of her movie star smiles and a near 90-degree bow.
"Likewise," said Ryo.
Then, turning to Corwin, he said in a matter-of-fact voice, "I'm hugely confused, Ted." Minami chuckled indulgently. "I'm sure there's a very simple explanation, Ryo."
"Oh, not so much," said Korra with a knowing smile and a shake of her head.
Anthy gave them the short version. After summarizing the matter for Jinora the other day, she felt she was getting to be something of an expert at it. Once she'd finished, there were a few moments' silence, during which neither Sato's face was easily readable while they digested what they'd just been told. Then Minami seemed to reach a conclusion. She blinked in sudden epiphany. Then her green eyes went wide with delighted amazement.
"Corwin," she declared, turning to face him, "you're prepared to father other women's children as a personal favor?"
Then, to his complete surprise, she became the second woman that day to leap into his arms, though the overall effect was slightly different, given how much taller Minami was than Korra.
"There's a future for the Sato line after all," Minami declared happily, hugging him soundly.
"That's not," said Corwin, while Ryo gave a painful-sounding snort that turned into a short coughing jag. Anthy giggled, Korra gave Minami a disapproving frown, and Utina just eyed the scene dubiously.
"It makes so much sense, though," Minami persisted, stepping back without entirely releasing him. "You're a genius, I'm a genius. You're good with tools, I'm good with tools. You're handsome, I'm a Sato. Our children will be supermen."
She threw back her head and let out a film villain laugh.
"What's going on?" Garnet demanded blearily, raising her head. "Can't a hatchling get a little sleep around here?"
"Wah," said Ryo, taking a half step back. "Hello."
Minami jumped slightly, startled out of her reverie. "Hatchling?" Corwin gently extricated himself from the remains of her embrace and sat down on the edge of the bed, stroking the little dragon's head. "Sorry," he said. "It's just Minami being herself. Minami, Ryo, this is Garnet. Remember Noel when we were kids? Well, same deal."
"Oh," said Ryo. "Right, okay, dragon. Sure, why not?"
For the record, the dragon companion thing would be entirely optional.
Minami allowed. That might actually make the product of our destined union too powerful.
I am not out to stud, Corbin objected.
At least not until Usna and I figure out the fee structure, Anthy put in not very helpfully, making Utna utter an I-didn't-really-want-to-laugh-at-that laugh.
Well, I'm not talking about right now. I mean, it's a process, Minami said. I'm only 22. I have a lot of things to do. But, you know, eventually, someone has to carry on the line, and it's no use looking to Ryo to pick up that slack.
Oi, Ryo protested.
Korra sighed. Don't make me lightning bend you, Minami. Ryo would complain.
I would? Ryo asked, as if that were news to him.
Minami sighed as if unfairly put upon.
Fine, forget it. It'd probably be too much like kissing my brother anyway.
She smiled again, a little slyly this time, and couldn't resist tossing in as a parting shot.
He is good with tools, though. And that is hot.
Cornered that completely, Utna had to admit that this was so. And then, the moment having broken, everyone laughed. Minami and Ryo stayed for lunch, where there was plenty of room at the Avatar's table. The Pons and Anne had all gone into town. Anthy had already declared her intention to remain in or near bed all day. Nima had matters to attend to elsewhere, and Nal and Lakpa seemed to have wandered off somewhere, leaving only Corwin, Utna, and Caitlin, who had returned to the island just before lunchtime, to share the midday meal with Korra and the Satos. Ryo considered the items on offer, rice, seaweed, various sliced vegetables, and a bottle of vinegar, and, without comment, began assembling Hosomaki. While he worked, his deft hand seeming to be on autopilot, he picked up the thread of an earlier conversation and said to Corwin,
"So listen, son, this thing with the Tribune."
"I told you, Ryo, I have no idea," Corwin said. "I don't even get what it is they think I'm trying to do."
"To hear the man who sneaked into my office tell it, their society editors think you're planning to sweep Korra off her feet and carry her off back to your fairy castle in the sky, or wherever it is you keep yourself when you're not here," said Minami dryly.
Korra choked on a sip of tea, then coughed explosively into a napkin as Corwin thumped her in the center of the back with the flat of his hand. Thanking him absently, she wiped her face, put the napkin and teacup down, and hunted among the stack of papers by the side of the table until she came up with the morning's Republic City Tribune, which they hadn't had time or inclination to give its usual inspection at breakfast time. Sure enough, there on the first page of Section 4 was the usual blaring headline, this one reading, "What Can It Mean?" Below, the usual stack of ever-shrinking sub-headlines was absent, but there was a photograph of Corwin and Korra at Naruk's seaweed noodlery the previous evening. This was slightly grainy, but quite good considering how surreptitiously it must have been taken. They were both smiling broadly, plainly having a blast. She had him in a headlock, having had to climb more or less halfway into his lap to do it, given the disparity in their heights, his near arm trapped between them, and was administering a brisk mock noogie, while he had the heel of his free hand under her chin in what was obviously a deliberately ineffective effort to fend her off. "Republic City, Sanue 17, Korra read, more to herself than anyone else at the table. "The story of this city's exotic visitors took a strange turn tonight." She trailed off into inarticulate mumbling, skimming through the article, her expression becoming more and more incredulous. Then she put down the paper and dropped her forehead into her hand. "Oh, my aching back."
"What? What is it?"
Corwin wondered as Kate picked up the paper and started perusing the article herself.
"When we saw Emily last night at Naruk's," Cora said without looking up, "remember at the end when we were leaving she was all worked up about something?"
"I was kind of in non-maskable interrupt mode by then," Corwin remarked dryly. "But yes, I seem to recall something to that effect."
"She seemed angry," Caitlin observed. "And I think I see why now," she added after a moment's reading.
"I don't," said Corwin, sounding a bit lost. Cora dropped her hand and looked at him.
"She thought we were on a date," she said. "And she's been covering you guys," she added, gesturing between him and Utena, "on your honeymoon."
Corwin blinked.
"Oh," he said, and then, philosophically, "well, that would explain the 'you beast, how could you' look she gave me on her way out."
Utena raised her eyebrows.
"That's quite a conclusion to jump to," she observed. Then, getting a good look at the photo, she went on,
"although having seen this?"
"It's true," Caitlin concurred with a slightly evil smile. "If you had been on a date, given that it's you two, it would have looked exactly the same to Miss Wong."
That's friend stuff," Cora protested, nearly losing hold of the sentence for a second. Then, picking up her tea, she gave Kate a sidelong glare and repeated in a low mutter,
"We're friends. That's what friends do."
"And that's exactly what you'd say," Kate went on, her smile becoming a little more wicked as she glanced pointedly from Utena to Corwin.
"I know the signs."
Utena gave a sheepish grin, her face going red over the bridge of her nose, and took Corwin's nearer hand.
"Was it really that obvious?" she wondered.
"No more so than a car accident," Kate reassured her, taking another bit of veggie sushi from the serving platter Ryo had been preparing the whole time and popping it in her mouth. In exchange, he snagged the paper from her and started reading the article.
"All those in favor of throwing Master Caitlin in the ornamental pond out by Tenzin's house, raise your hands," said Cora, putting up her own.
"Threaten me all you like, Avatar," said Caitlin placidly. "I'm not afraid to speak truth to power."
Cora subsided, grumbling, then gave her a speculative look as a thought struck her.
"Is that so?" she wondered.
Seeming to will herself back to casualness, she picked up her chopsticks and helped herself to a bit of hosomaki as well.
"How'd you like a job?"
"I have a job," said Kate.
"Actually, I have several jobs. What's one more? What did you have in mind?"
"Well, it so happens that the Order of the White Lotus is short of Master Lotus or three just at the moment."
"Whoa, did you read the rest of this?" Ryo interrupted. "It goes way beyond 'you guys were on a date' at the end here. I think Min Min was right, what she said earlier. Check it out." "What Avatar Korra plans to do with her new conquest, now that she has severed him from his exotic companion, is far from clear. But we cannot ignore the possibility that she may return with him to wherever on the outside he comes from. The cause for concern here is plain. The consequences of such a cavalier abandonment of her duties would be grave indeed. We can only wait and hope that discretion and the needs of her world win out over our hot-blooded Avatar's latest fiery infatuation." He put down the paper and gave the rest of the table a startled look.
"Conquest? Abandonment? Infatuation? Them's fightin' words, boys and girls."
He frowned thoughtfully at the article.
"And they ended a sentence with a preposition. Though, in fairness, that would be an awkward one to recast. Whencesoever on the outside he may come?
Cora's chopsticks snapped in her hand. Without another word, she took out her gear phone and thumbed it to life, speaking sharply to the person who answered her call.
Chiang.
Yes, I see it.
No. No longer amused. I want...
What? Hang on. She reached and took the paper from in front of Ryo, dragging it back to her own place.
Aha! No, I didn't see that. Good catch.
She gave a tight little smile at something Chiang said, then replied,
Okay, fair enough. I'll stand down from DEFCON 1, but I'm still pretty damn ticked. Get hold of Miss Wong and tell her to get her ass to the Jasmine Dragon at 5th and Plum, RTFN. Non-negotiable.
No, I'm not meeting her myself. You are. I'm sending someone from my new team to go in with you. Get down there and size her up. See how much of this came from her. If you think she's still being straight with us, bring her here. If not...
Cora sighed. I don't know what, if not.
I'll have to figure it out then, okay?
Thanks.
No, she'll meet you there. You'll know her when you see her.
No, not Utna. She's too much like me. There'd probably be punching.
Corbin snickered and elbowed Utna, who rolled her eyes, drawing a muted giggle from Kate.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, buddy. See ya.
Switching off the phone, Cora closed it and put it away, then let out a great, weary, slouching sigh. After a moment, she became aware of the other's eyes on her again and looked up.
What?
Your new team? Kate wondered impishly. Cora shrugged.
Everybody says I've got one. Who am I to blow against the wind? She replied.
Also, I think I just accepted that place in the White Lotus for you. Sorry about that. Got a little carried away.
Mustering a wry little smile, she added,
The duties are largely ceremonial.
Kate smiled.
I was planning to take it anyway, she said. It sounds interesting. Is there a snappy uniform?
As a matter of fact, there is, said Cora.
What got you back from Scorch the Earth mode? Minami wondered.
This, Cora said, turning the paper around and pushing it across to her, then tapping the place where Emily's byline would normally be.
No byline. A staff report, Minami said, understanding at once. She glanced to the bottom of the article.
Our correspondent Emily Wong contributed to this report.
She must have filed something a little more cautious, Corwin mused.
And her editors decided it wasn't punchy enough, Utna agreed, nodding.
Typical. Remember that Zeta Cygni Post article after our fight with the Amar?
The one with the picture of you being all adorably pissed off with the girl from Avalon this afternoon?
Corwin replied with a grin.
I have a copy of that front page on my wall at home.
Utna snorted.
No, that was the cornet's sigh. That article was all right.
Well, I don't look at the nameplate that often, Corwin explained, waggling his eyebrows.
Anyway, Utna went on doggedly, the Post article was about me and Dad and how they figured I got the Valiant job.
Oh, that article, said Kate, nodding sagely.
Yeah, said Utna, scowling at the memory. The one that's why the Post got all new editors that month.
I had erased those memory sectors, Corwin objected.
Now they're back. Unclean! Unclean!
Utna shoulder-checked him, knocking him into Cora, which broke her out of a frowny reverie over the newspaper. Instinctively, she bumped back, and there ensued a bit of a jostling match at that end of the table that dissolved into giggling.
Okay, said Cora. I feel better. For the moment.
Kate, you'd better get ready to head into town. Go see Janora. She'll set you up. It's important to look the part.
1:24 p.m. The Jasmine Dragon Tea House. 5th Avenue and Plum Street, Republic City.
Emily Wong arrived in the tea room feeling, well, if she were to be honest, feeling ever so faintly scared. She had, over the last week or so, developed what she had flattered herself was a reasonably good working relationship with Master Chiang, the White Lotus Master who managed Avatar Korra's press relations. He hadn't told her much of anything useful, but their conversations had at least been cordial, bordering on friendly. Her interactions with him, like her pursuit of the mysterious foreigner's story generally, had taken on the flavor of a game. Now, though, she had the distinct impression that that was all over. His call, not to her desk in the Section 4 bullpen, where she hadn't been all day anyway, but to her personal mobile phone, had been terse to the point of curtness, and he had sounded very much displeased about something. His tone made it plain that she wasn't being asked to meet him at the Jasmine Dragon, she was being told to, and not for any purpose she was likely to enjoy. She wondered what had happened to make him angry. Surely it couldn't have been anything she had done. Emily was a little early, having agreed to meet Chiang and an unspecified colleague at 1:30. Taking a table in the corner, she ordered a pot of jasmine oolong, hoping that it would simultaneously perk her up and settle her nerves, and then settled in to watch the entrance. At this time of day, the customers were mainly students from nearby Republic City U, coming in to use the free wire, talk over their morning classes, and/or cut their afternoon ones. She was sipping her first cup and watching the entrance when a lately familiar voice said behind her, "Miss Wong, thank you for coming." Emily nearly jumped out of her skin, coming halfway upright with a yelp that drew looks from the nearby tables, as a middle-aged man in a blue business suit slipped around her and took the seat opposite. He was tall and thin, rather dark, but not Water Tribe dark, with a narrow, ascetic face. His only evident hair was a pair of heavy black eyebrows. As he seated himself, his expression betrayed carefully contained vestiges of the anger that had been plain on the phone, but also a faintly apologetic air. "Sorry," he said. "I don't know how I keep doing that." "Where did you come from?" Emily demanded, sitting back down and mopping up the tea she'd spilled. "I was watching the door." "Through the kitchen," said another voice from the same place. Emily turned to see the second speaker, a young woman, slim and pretty in a foreign sort of way, dressed in a skirted version of the same natty blue suit the man was wearing, and with the same discreet White Lotus lapel pin. She had long, slightly curly brown hair, and big, round Outlander eyes a shade or two darker, behind circular wire-rimmed spectacles. As she seated herself at the side of the table, she leaned her dark wood walking stick carefully against its edge, ready to hand. "As I'm sure you've figured out by now, I am Master Chiang of the White Lotus Society," said the man. Nodding toward the woman, he added, "My colleague, Master Caitlin." "You were at Naruk's," said Emily to Caitlin, surprised. "And Chow's before that." The woman smiled slightly. "You're perceptive," she said. "That's good." Emily looked her over, taking the remark as a sort of challenge, besides which it was an instinct by now. "You have the same ring as the others," she said. Caitlin surprised her slightly by not glancing at the pink rose signet ring she wore, which would surely have been the natural reaction. Instead, her smile got a little wider, and she said, "You're very perceptive." Then, her expression suddenly hardening, she withdrew part of the Morning Tribune from inside her suit jacket and slapped it down on the table in front of Emily, adding in a slightly cold voice, "Much too perceptive to have drawn these conclusions." Emily blinked. "What? I didn't draw any conclusions. In fact, I went out of my way not to draw any conclusions."
"You haven't read the article, then," said Chiang.
I haven't even seen today's paper yet, Emily told him. I've been up to my armpits in the morgue all day. She paused as what she'd just said seemed to dawn on her, then added, the newspaper one, not the dead bodies one.
Well, perhaps you should familiarize yourself with it now, Chang suggested, so that we're all on the same page. Now it was his turn to pause. As it were.
As Emily read the morning's Section 4 front page, Caitlin marveled silently as she watched the stages of the reporter's reaction march plainly across her face. Curiosity, confusion, dawning horror, embarrassment, fury. At length, she put down the paper, looked from one blue-clad figure to the other, and said in a voice that almost trembled with a mix of the last two,
I did not write this.
Chang regarded her thoughtfully for a moment, then turned a questioningly arched eyebrow to Caitlin, who nodded.
What did you write? Kate asked.
Emily hesitated, then pulled herself together with a sigh and a sip of tea.
I can show you. I still have my own copy, she said, touching the cover of her notebook.
The first couple of graphs here are mine, mostly, the factual part, she added with a trace of dark wryness. What I saw, and where I saw it. The rest of my version was the exact opposite of this trash. I warned my readers not to jump to conclusions. The analysis, if you even want to dignify it with that name, that's someone else.
She considered for a second, then said, Probably Kazu. He's hack enough to come up with a crap phrase like, to wherever on the outside he comes from.
Chung steepled his fingertips before him and said judiciously, I'm curious how you thought you could present this information, particularly this photograph, without any explanatory context, and expect people not to jump to conclusions. Something in Emily broke loose at that. Banging a fist down on the newspaper, she blazed, Don't take that tone with me. Have you ever had to work to a deadline? She gestured vaguely in the direction of the Tribune building and went on, I've been searching for that context for the past 16 hours. I've had to, because someone thought it would be funny to just string me along all week. Folding her arms, she shook her head at him and snapped, Oh no, Master Lotus, I'm not taking the fall for this on my own. Chang gave her another of those long, thoughtful looks, then turned to Caitlin and said dryly, I am forced to concede that Miss Wong has a point, Master Caitlin. Kate nodded. She agreed. Then, addressing Emily, she said, No one's looking for anyone to take a fall for anything. We just want to get this situation back under control.
I was supposed to meet with them on Air Temple Island tomorrow, said Emily. I had hoped that my own analysis would be in print by then, so they could tell me how close I came, but now... well...
She sighed, shrugging. Exactly, said Kate. Which is why we'd like you to come out to the island today, so that we can get everything sorted out.
How stupid do I look to you? Asked Emily. I'm not going anywhere near the Avatar after this. She'll kill me.
Chang gave her an incredulous scowl.
No, she won't. Don't be ridiculous.
Caitlin shot him a slightly severe glance.
Don't belittle her concerns, Master Chang, she said. Of course, Korra isn't literally going to kill her, but she has a perfect right to be anxious.
Chang frowned, then nodded. You're quite right, he conceded, and then inclined his head to Emily and said, My apologies, Miss Wong.
Emily, it's true Korra was very angry when she read this, said Kate, touching the newspaper. She still will be, with the people responsible,
That's why Chiang and I came here, to assess whether you were one of them. If we thought you were, well, we wouldn't be inviting you to the island. You'll be perfectly safe, I promise.
Emily held eye contact with her for a moment, then sighed again and took another sip of her tea.
All right, she said.
Then, signaling the waitress, she asked, Can I get this to go, please?
Chiang insisted on settling the bill, including springing for one of the Jasmine Dragon's cunning little thermos jugs in place of the usual paper to-go cup. Emily gathered up her notebook and the paper in one hand, took the thermos from the waitress with the other, and followed the two Master Lotuses outside. She assumed they would be heading for the ferry terminal, but instead she found that there was a third person waiting for them, a young air nomad girl, rail thin and buzz-cut, sitting perched on the head of a sky bison. She had a winged lemur stationed on one of her narrow shoulders, and was dressed in what Emily recognized as very formal air nomad clothes, full, blousy pants, and an oval-hemmed cloak over a high-collared tunic. Instead of the usual oranges and reds, her outfit was the same rich, dark blue as the suits Chiang and Caitlin wore, but for the broad, tasseled white sash around her waist. Seeing them emerge, this remarkable specimen smiled broadly.
Hello, Miss Wong, she said. I'm Nima, and this is Makoto and Vayu, she added, petting first the lemur and then her bison's head. Have you ever flown before?
Only in an aeroplane, said Emily.
And did you enjoy it?
Emily hesitated.
It was all right?
Well, this will be much better, Nima assured her, gesturing for her to climb up to the saddle behind her with Chiang and Caitlin.
Just relax, and we'll have you on the island in no time.
Emily began to comply. On her way up, she asked,
Wait, you're a Master Lotus? How old are you?
16. Nima replied, unconcerned.
Emily reached the top, where Chiang gave her a hand over the gunwale of the saddle. She thanked him, then went forward to lean over the pommel and ask Nima,
How'd that happen?
Nima's smile was undiminished as she replied blithely, I studied hard and ate my vegetables. Then, twitching the reins, she declared,
Yip, yip, Vayu!
On Air Temple Island, Cora, Corwin, and Duchina had determined that Anthy, though still fully intent on staying in bed basically all day, would be happy to change rooms if, for example, they were to set up a nice futon-style daybed for her in the sun parlor on the south side of the house. Since this was a particularly pleasant room anyway, and would make a good site for receiving further company, they'd inquired of Jinora where such a thing could be found, and she'd directed them to one in an upstairs bedroom. They brought it down, then hunted up a couple of armchairs to go with it and the couch that was already out there, setting up a nice little conversational grouping. Now, as Anthy finished arranging herself, Annabelle, and Garnet upon said futon, and Corwin carried in the last of the armchairs, Cora's gearphone rang.
Hello, she said.
Yeah. Okay.
Problems?
Good.
Okay, thanks. See you soon.
She closed the phone, put it away, and said,
They're on their way.
Kate says she thinks Emily's just as surprised as we are.
This should be interesting, Jinora remarked.
Uchina nudged Cora with an elbow, grinning.
I'll give you 10,000 gold ren if you give her that cute photo Kate took of you and Corwin Monday night and tell her you're eloping.
Cora gave her a startled look, but before she could remark, Corwin said to Uterna,
You started this, Elsker. Don't make it worse. Also, where are you going to get 10,000 gold ren?
I could turn to banditry, Uterna suggested, settling on the daybed next to Anthy. Addressing her next remark ostensibly to Annabelle, she went on,
I mean, you saw the paper, right? What have I got to lose? The Avatar's stolen my husband.
It's like herding cat owls, Korra muttered to Jinora, but the airbender only smiled her, This is your problem, dear, but I'll gladly watch you try to solve it, smile. Rolling her eyes in response, Korra turned back to the others and said, I can't believe I'm the one saying this, but let's try to focus, people.
Hey, I'm the injured party here. I get to laugh, Uchina said.
She stretched her legs out full length in front of her, crossed at the ankle, and leaned back with her hands behind her head.
I'll be good when she gets here, I promise.
She paused, thinking, then added offhandedly, That really is a cute photo, though.
It's true, Anthy agreed.
Not helping, Anthy, Korra grumbled.
Anthy smiled benevolently.
It's sweet how you assume I was trying to, she said.
Okay, they're here, Corwin reported from the window. Turning back, he proposed,
How about we try to pretend we're grown-ups?
Anthy sighed.
Oh, very well, if you insist.
Well, I'll leave you to your conference, said Jinora. My hopes for a satisfactory resolution. I'll see you at dinner.
Thanks, Jinora. See you later, said Corwin.
I don't know how you do it,
Korra admitted to Jinora as she walked with the Grandmaster to the front door.
After growing up with Iki and Milo, the rest of the world is easy,
Jinora replied serenely, then took her leave. Korra stayed at the door to greet Emily, Kate, and Chiang when they arrived. Chiang parted from them at that point, remarking darkly that he thought he might best serve by heading back to town and depositing a word or two into certain ears at the Tribune. Korra showed the other two down the hall to the Sun Parlor. Before she could start making introductions or find some other way of breaking at least a little of what was, in frankness, some pretty thick ice, Emily took the matter out of her hands by marching up to Corwin and declaring flatly,
Your name isn't Watari Karasu. You're Corwin Ravenhair, the eldest of IPO Chief Griffin's three sons. You had been visiting this world semi-regularly since a few months after you were born in 2391, but you stopped coming in 2404, and this is the first time you've been back since then. No one seems to know just what it is you do for a living, but by all accounts I could find, you're quite clever.
Leaving him to give her a surprised, impressed look, she turned to Uchina, who had risen to her feet alongside the futon when the reporter entered, and went on,
Your name is Uchina Tenjo. The Big Universe Wire Service reports say you are a master swordswoman and one of the IPO's Crusader for Galactic Justice types. You've never been to Dicho before. In fact, you don't seem to be from anywhere. You just appeared out of nowhere not long after Corwin's last visit here.
She shook her head. A real international mystery woman.
But that pales in comparison to you, she went on, addressing Anthy. She was carrying a notebook, but they'd all noticed by this point that she wasn't consulting it, as she hit the high points of her findings about each.
There's virtually nothing about you in any public record I could get my hands on in the past 16 hours or so. I know your name is Anthy, and you and Uchina have been married for 4 years as of yesterday, but before your wedding you don't appear to have existed at all, which is frankly a little creepy.
She angled a thumb back at Corwin.
Also, I'm fuzzy on how she can have been on her honeymoon with him last weekend, given the proceeding, but let's leave that for the moment.
Finally, turning to Kate, she said, And you are Caitlin Hutchins, Chief Griffin's eldest daughter, Corwin's half-sister. You're a rock star, a movie star, you do your own stunts, and you'll be New Avalon University's Associate Professor of Music the nanosecond you finish your PhD. And, she added without missing more than one beat as Serge sauntered in from the hall and pushed his head under Kate's free hand, you apparently have a pet tiger.
Turning a slow circle to take all of them in, she concluded, "Plus, you all seem to be pals with the Avatar. I feel like I just crashed an Overachievers Anonymous meeting." No one replied for a moment. Then Utina said, "You're not doing so bad yourself. That's more than I thought you'd have turned up." Emily put her hands on her hips and gave Utina a challenging look. "You want to know the really impressive part? I got all that since 9:30 last night." With another, this time rueful, shake of her head, she went on, "Normally I wouldn't brag about that, but it comes with its own shameful confession to balance it out. Save that for later. What the heck is going on?" Before anyone could attempt an answer, she turned to Cora, gestured to Corwin, and went on, "And why were you two out on a date last night? I mean, I understand now that it was their wedding anniversary," she said, nodding toward the futon. "So that's why they went to Kwong's by themselves, and I know it was Caitlin's birthday, but that scene at Naruk's, something was going on there." Looking Cora in the eye, she asked bluntly, "What are you to him, Avatar?" Cora thought about her answer for a moment, looking steadily back at her. Then she said, "Well, I suppose, if you get right down to it, I'm his godmother." Corwin stepped up next to the Avatar and put a hand on her shoulder, adding in a gentle voice, "And a very dear friend." Cora smiled wryly, reflexively reaching up to touch his hand, and glanced at him. "Well, that went without saying," she said. And just for an instant, as she glanced at him, there it was again. That same look, the one from the photo Emily hadn't submitted for publication, the one that had set her on the 16-hour odyssey of research she'd just finished. Many-layered, hyper-contextual, and so intensely personal that Emily felt she was intruding on something just by having witnessed it. What the young reporter received then, seeing it live and in person, wasn't a flash of insight, exactly. In many ways, she was none the wiser for it. But it was certainly a glimpse of some lower-level cosmic base code truth. Emily didn't know what that truth was. Rather, in that moment, she understood that it probably wasn't hers to know, and that whatever it was, there was beauty in it. "Oh," she said, feeling that it was a trifle lame, and yet the only thing she could say. Corwin gave Cora's shoulder a squeeze, then released it and crossed the room to sit down on the edge of the futon next to Anthe. At the same time, Utina resumed her station on the other side. Once she was settled, Caitlin perched herself on the mattress's edge next to her, with Serge curling up contentedly on the floor beside. "You mentioned that you know I haven't been back to Decho since 2404, Corwin said. "What you probably don't know is that that wasn't by choice. Cora and I haven't seen each other in 6 years because we couldn't. There were people scheming to keep us apart." "So she wouldn't meet me, of all the lame-brained ideas," Utina put in. "So that's what you saw last night," Corwin went on. "Old friends making up for stolen time." "Not me breaking up my godson's 5-day-old marriage," Cora added sarcastically, seating herself in the armchair next to the daybed. "Take a seat," she said, gesturing to the one on the opposite side. "And what was that crap about me running out on Decho?" Emily sat, feeling a little awkward now. "That wasn't me," she said, and explained, her annoyance smoothing over the hesitancy, that the article she'd filed had been, if she did say so herself, a marvel of circumspection, and that she suspected her stupid so-called colleague Kazu had been the one called on by her editor to spice things up a bit, with catastrophic results. By the end, she'd reached the point where she was unconsciously speaking more loudly, and Anthe was just about to ask her if she'd mind keeping her voice down when Garnet raised her head
peered around, and then inquired wearily of Annabelle,
"Why is it our destiny to be surrounded by shouty people today, Dove Fadon?"
Emily recoiled in shock and stared for a moment. Her cheeks reddened as she realized that, for all that Caitlin had recently praised her perceptiveness, she hadn't noticed that the adults weren't alone in the room.
"A baby," she said, as if not quite certain whether to believe it. "And a dragon?"
"Yeah, you're definitely a reporter," Garnet snarked, snuggling back down against Annabelle's shoulder.
"This is our daughter Annabelle," Anthy said, "and her boon companion Garnet."
Emily smiled at the infant, who looked back with an expression of vague, abstract benevolence, then seemed to dismiss the visitor from her calculations and return to considering the ceiling instead. Then, a thoughtful frown coming onto her face, the reporter said,
"Who is our in this context?"
"Well," said Anthy, taking Utina's right hand and her left, "I prefer to think of us all as her parents, the three of us. But if you must look at it technically, mine and Corwin's." Emily's natural reaction to that was to glance at Utina, who shrugged and said wryly, "I'm a multi-talented woman, but that particular trick is beyond me." Emily blushed again, looking away, but couldn't quite suppress an embarrassed smile at that. These people were strange, but very charming in their strangeness. She'd felt that about Utina and Corwin the first night she'd met them, at the Velvet Palanquin, and she felt it again now. She could see how a person would get drawn into their orbit and never get out again, never particularly want to.
"So, yeah, you've got most of the rough outline already," Corwin put in. "If your editor hadn't gotten so antsy, your follow-up probably would have been good enough that our meeting tomorrow would have just been us giving you a gold star," he added with a grin.
"I still have a couple of questions, if you don't mind," said Emily.
"Sure, but I have one for you first," Utina said.
"What is it?" Emily wondered.
"You said you had a shameful confession to balance out the bragging about how good you are at research," Utina prompted.
"Fair's fair."
Emily smiled.
"I suppose it is." Then, sobering, she considered how to phrase what she had to say for a moment before looking at Corwin and saying,
"When I saw you and Avatar Korra at Naruk's last night, I did assume more or less what Kazu's version of the article ended up saying. Not necessarily the part about Korra leaving us," she qualified, "but I thought you were there on a real date. That she had..." She reddened again.
"I don't know, convinced you to leave your bride and be with her instead. I was... hurt. Shocked that she would do such a thing. Disappointed that you would go along with it. A woman I've looked up to and respected my whole life. And a man I thought I'd gotten a pretty good read on when he rescued my Minox from the bouncer at the Velvet Pal." She added with a wry little smile.
"What changed your mind?" Anthy wondered.
"Well..." Emily looked across the futon at Korra.
"It was you, Avatar," she said.
Korra looked puzzled.
"Me?"
"After our little confrontation outside the noodlery, I went home and developed my film. I had that same mini-camera with me, and I knew I had managed to get a few good shots."
"You process your own film?" Corwin asked.
"Nice."
"I have to," Emily replied. "The Tribune's photo lab wouldn't know what to do with Minox film. They're going all computerized anyway, but I don't trust that stuff. Where's the archival permanence? They can't even read the magnetic tapes from the Phoenix flight mission at Future Industries anymore."
She reddened slightly as she realized she'd wandered off the beam a little. "Anyway, I developed my film and started printing the better frames. And,
Well, in one of them.
Emily opened her notebook to the back, removed a photograph, and tossed it onto the futon. It slid across the smooth coverlet, stopping just before it would have gone off the edge and fallen at Cora's feet. She bent forward in her chair, turning it so it was right way up for her, and considered it with eyebrows rising. It showed herself and Corwin, framed roughly the same as they had been in the photo that had run on the Section 4 front page, but in a different moment. He was talking to someone off-camera. Juniper, if Cora remembered right how they had been sitting. And she was looking at him, their eyelines such that she would have had him in profile. She didn't remember having had that wistful, where did you come from all of a sudden look on her face, but she supposed she must have. Seeing it now, and knowing the others around her were seeing it too, she felt the bridge of her nose go a bit hot. Corwin leaned in over her shoulder to have his own look at the photo. After a moment's consideration, all he said, in a judicious sort of voice, was, "Well."
"That is not the look a woman gives a man she has just stolen from his wife," Emily said hesitantly.
Anthe leaned forward a bit so she could get a closer look as well, then smiled.
"No," she agreed. "No, indeed."
"When I saw that, I knew I was wrong," said Emily. "And for a second, I..." She hesitated again, looking down at her hands and loose fists on her knees, then went on in a smaller voice. "I was disappointed."
Cora looked up from the photo. "Disappointed?"
Emily nodded, not meeting her eyes.
"Yes. Because I thought I had a really juicy thing to report, and then it slipped away from me. And then it hit me how wrong that thought process was. How sleazy. And I suddenly realized that I'd turned into exactly the thing I'd always prided myself that I wasn't. I might be paying my dues at the Trib by putting in a couple of years in Section 4, I always told myself, but I wasn't going to be just another society page celebrity gossip creep. I wasn't going to take pleasure in human frailty, or glory in making people's private things public. Except that's exactly what I'd been looking forward to doing. I didn't even realize it consciously, until that photo brought it all back into focus for me." She looked around from one to another, shamefaced, then back at her knees as she continued, "I hadn't even tried to take up the challenge Uchina laid out for me at the Velvet Pal, to go and find out who she and Corwin really were on my own. To be a real reporter, like I always told myself I was, I just merrily trailed them around town, waiting to see what they would do next, spinning theories and looking for evidence that backed them, waiting for someone to do something that my editor would be really interested in, ignoring most of the potential for real news, looking for dirt instead." Emily looked up again, seeming like she might be on the verge of tears. "I don't know when it happened exactly. It was so subtle I can't trace it back now. But somewhere in the last couple of years, I lost my way. I was disappointed that my childhood idol turned out not to be a homewrecker. How screwed up is that?" she demanded. Not waiting for an answer, she went on, "That was about 9:30 last night. I went straight to the office, filed a different photo and a really cautious report. I had to file something. And then I really went to work. I trawled the morgue. I hit the lightning web. I phoned the New Avalon Cornet Psi. Spirits help me, they'll probably make me pay for that call. I dug up everything I told you when I came in here, and a few more things besides. I had a good start on my follow-up to the report I thought had hit print this morning, when Chiang called, and, well, you know the rest." Cora picked up the photograph of herself from the bed,
considered it again for a few moments, then handed it to Caitlin and said, "Okay, you messed up. Like you said, you lost your way. You recognize that." Emily nodded miserably. "Then we don't need to dwell on it any further," Cora went on, causing the young reporter to blink at her in faintly hopeful disbelief. "The important thing isn't that you ended up down a hole," Cora explained to her disbelieving look. Utrina nodded, recognizing where she was going, and said, "The important thing is that you climbed out." Cora grinned and high-fived her without looking, then said to Emily, "Doing whatever it takes to fix a screw-up goes a lot further with me than never having screwed up in the first place." "If you never screwed up, that probably just means you weren't doing anything. Staying up all night to fix one? That shows character." Emily reddened once more, lowered her eyes, and mumbled, "Thank you, Avatar." "Call me Cora," said the Avatar with an easy smile. While Emily was taking that on board, Utrina said, "So, you had a couple more questions, you said." Blinking rapidly, Emily took a moment to get herself back on task, then said, Yes. This one's not for publication so much as my own understanding, but, She looked from one end of the little group on the futon to the other, reddening a bit, and asked hesitantly, "How did you three... you know?" Anthy momentarily considered remarking that as yet they hadn't all three... you know, but decided that between them they'd put the poor girl through enough already. Instead, she glanced at the others, then said, "Years ago... Utrina and I were roommates at boarding school. In time," she added, taking the pink-haired woman's hand and exchanging a smile with her, "we fell in love. Unfortunately, there were some difficulties with my family." Utrina stifled a laugh. "And she was obliged to leave me for a time. Her roommate at her new school was Caitlin, with whom she did not have the courtesy to fall in love, thank you very much," said Kate, mock petulantly, earning herself a grinning swat from Utrina. "And Corwin is her brother," Anthy continued as if she hadn't been interrupted. "He and Utrina are naturally very compatible, so it was only to be expected that they would find themselves together. I won't bore you with the details," she went on lightly, "but eventually Corwin was able to reunite Utrina and me, for which gallant act he earned my heart as well," she added, leaning to kiss his cheek with an impish smile, "and, well, it took rather a lot of doing, to be honest, and got a bit tiresome at times, but here we are at last. Utrina is my husband, Corwin is her husband, Annabelle is our daughter." "And Dragon makes 5, said Garnet sleepily. "There are dragons in the big universe?" Emily wondered. "Oh, sure," Garnet mumbled. "Loads. Places swarming with us. What are we talking about?" "Nothing. Go back to sleep," said Corwin, reaching to stroke her head, then Annabelle's.
"Okay,"
murmured the dragon, her gem-like golden eyes slipping shut again. Emily shook her head. "You guys are crazy," she said. "I thought so at the Velvet Pal, and now I'm sure of it." Then she grinned, taking most of the sting out of it, and added, "I like your flavor of crazy, though." "Hey, sometimes crazy works," said Utrina, leaning to kiss Anthy on the cheek. "Okay, next question," Emily went on. This time she actually opened her notebook and got out a pencil, propping the one on her knee to stabilize it for the other. "This one is for the record. What have you got planned next?" Utrina, Corwin, and Anthy glanced at each other, all puzzlement between them. "You said it yourself.
Cora put in before any of them could attempt a response. Corwin's the IPO chief's son, and Utena here is one of his up-and-coming galactic go-getters. She threw Utena a wink. In the next little while, we'll all be looking at ways of increasing communications across the Veil. Strengthening ties. She sat back in her chair, ankles crossed, and grinned. It's a project I've been trying to get off the ground for years, and now it looks like we finally have an opportunity to make a start on it. How will that affect day-to-day life in Republic City? Emily wondered, perking up at the scent of actual news. Cora shrugged. Odds are it won't, at least in the short to medium term. She said, I mean, we're not looking at wholesale integration into the galactic community. I don't think you'd find many people who even want that. On the other hand, we need a better way of knowing what's going on out there. It's really about communication. Emily nodded, jotting some notes. Isn't everything, she said wryly, recalling again their own recent difficulties with same. Yeah, listen, I'm sorry about that, said Utena, hand behind head. My brilliant plan got a little out of hand. In my defense, it seemed like a good idea at the time, she added sheepishly. Thank you, said Emily, a surprised and pleased smile touching her face. Then, a little ruefully, she added, I think it's fair to say that this whole mess doesn't represent anyone's finest hour. Except maybe Chiang's for putting up with a lot of us, Corwin quipped, drawing an only slightly awkward laugh. Speaking of which, Miss Wong, Cora put in. Emily turned back to her. Yes? Cora gave her a judicious look, then asked bluntly, Tell me something. Are you brave? Like, physically brave? I already know you've got moral courage, or you wouldn't have just admitted all that to a room full of total strangers. But can you handle it when dangerous stuff is happening? Emily looked confused. Yeah, I can take care of myself. I'm an earthbender. Cora's eyebrows went up. Really? Even better. Okay, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. You know the Red Monsoon Triad? We haven't been formally introduced, said Emily dryly, but I'm familiar with the name. Cora chuckled. Okay. One more question. Do you know what comet is? In the astronomical sense, or... Cora shook her head. No, it's a street drug. Oh, said Emily. No, I haven't heard of it. That's not really my area at the moment. Well, it's some kind of designer variant on speed, we think. I'm not a chemist, so I couldn't tell you the details, but basically what it does is supercharge firebenders. Ah, hence the name, Emily said. Cora nodded. Exactly. It's fairly new, originated out west somewhere. Caused some real problems in Caldera City and Fire Fountain. The RCPD and I have been pretty lucky about keeping it from coming into the city in bulk so far, but it's starting to turn up regardless. And a buddy of mine in the Organized Crime Task Force, Inspector Imanishi, got a tip that the Red Monsoons are going to try and start a serious pipeline into town soon. Emily's brow furrowed. The Red Monsoons are waterbenders, she said. Why would they be interested in a drug for firebenders? They don't want to use it, they want to sell it, Cora told her. From that standpoint, it's actually better if it's something their own people don't have any use for. No reason for them to sample the merchandise. But they'd be making their own enemies more powerful if they sold it to, for instance, the Agni Kai. Cora nodded. I know. They must think they have some kind of angle. We're still looking into that. Anyway, the point is, we're reasonably sure they're going to move a major shipment of the stuff into the city sometime in the next few weeks,
and we think we'll know where and when in time to put a stop to it. So I'll cut you a deal. If you do what you can to tidy up the mess your editor made, so I don't actually have to have the White Lotus sue the Tribune for libel, which I don't want to do, but I will if I have to. And if you can keep the story quiet until you and I are agreed that you can break it without screwing up Etaro's case, I'll talk to him about getting you embedded with the task force when we go in for the raid. She grinned, her eyes twinkling. If you think you're up for that. Emily stared at the avatar, her eyes going wide.
You would do that for me? That could be my break. It would be my break. With my Bylon and a story like that, I could go anywhere.
I know, Cora said, still grinning.
For a chance like that, I'll typeset the retraction myself if I have to, Emily promised.
She got to her feet and bowed, hands linked in front of her chest.
Thank you, Avatar. I can't thank you enough.
Cora rose, walked around the futon, and clapped Emily on the shoulder.
I told you to call me Cora, she said.
Despite her fatigue and the emotional roller coaster she'd just ridden, Emily looked like she could have floated back to the mainland herself, she was riding so high on the outcome. Nima and Vayu gave her a lift anyway, just to be neighborly.
Where do you live, Emily?
Nima asked as Vayu sped out over the bay.
We can run you straight home.
Emily, leaning over the prow of the bison's saddle with her arms crossed atop it, opened her mouth to reply. Then she hesitated, a thoughtful expression stealing over her face, and she said,
Actually, Master Nima, if you don't mind, I think I'd like to check in at the office first.